This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stacio. Daryl Hunt served 19 years in prison for a rape and a murder he did not commit. The crime committed against him by the state, his wrongful conviction and wrongful imprisonment, stands as one of the most egregious examples of injustice built into our penal system. Ultimately, he was exonerated after battling the courts for nearly two decades. 12 years after his release from prison, he was found dead of an apparent suicide. As I prepare to leave this job as host of The State of Things, the story of Daryl Hunt is one that will not leave me. I spoke with him in July of 2007. Daryl was accused in the 1984 rape and murder of Deborah Sykes, a copy editor at The Sentinel, a former Winston-Salem newspaper. Deborah was white. Daryl was black. He was found guilty in her stabbing death, despite the lack of a murder weapon or any physical evidence linking him to the crime. So, two trials, no physical evidence, questionable witnesses, and a deeply flawed police investigation. Later, when DNA evidence failed to link him to the crime, he was still unable to get a new trial. It wasn't until DNA linked another man to the crime that the real murderer was found and subsequently confessed. And only then was some measure of justice, albeit diminished, brought to Deborah Sykes and Daryl Hunt. After he was released, Daryl created a nonprofit called the Daryl Hunt Project for Freedom and Justice. A documentary called The Trials of Daryl Hunt premiered on HBO a few months before I spoke with him. It was one of the most profound honors of my career to get to know Daryl Hunt through our conversations on the air as well as some events we attended together. His story, as I said earlier, stands as an object lesson in the way our penal system is built to fail people like Daryl. But what struck me even more deeply, and I hope you'll feel the same, is the way he came to personify forgiveness. Also in the studio that day in 2007 was Mark Rabel, who represented Daryl throughout his ordeal with the courts. Mark has also worked as a defense attorney in capital cases. Daryl Hunt was never outspoken. He was a man known for his quiet reserve. Since his release and the creation of his foundation, he was often placed center stage and asked to speak out. And I wondered how he was adjusting to the spotlight.
I'm adjusting. I'm still not quite used to it. I just take it as I did in prison, just one day at a time. And I'm thankful to have the opportunity to be here.
Yeah. How many times have you seen the film?
Maybe six.
Yeah.
That's about all I can.
Mark, how about you?
Maybe 10 or 11.
Is it difficult to watch, Daryl?
For me, it is, because for me, it brings back all the memories of, I remember sitting in the courtroom, I remember how I was feeling. Mm. I mean, all these feelings come back. And when I see myself and I know what I was looking at, one of the things I used to always stare at in the courtroom was the seal in front of the judge's bench. Mm. And I would just stare at it to try to numb the feelings of what was going on around.
What were the feelings?
It was just confusion, disappointment, hope, prayers, trying to figure out why I'm here.
Mm. Did you ever come up with answers? Did you, lay there late at night or staring at that seal? Make up answers? Why are you there? Why is this happening to me?
No, the only answer that I could come up with was that it was something God had planned. It was a reason bigger than anything that I can come up with.
There are those who, having come to that conclusion, might say, and therefore this is not a very good God.
I wouldn't say that because I believe the things that have happened for a reason, and a lot of good things have come about from what happened to me. Mm-hmm. And I think from what happened to me and people getting to know it now, it will prevent a lot of this from happening to someone else. So I think it's a great thing.
Yeah, but you know that now. And again, I'm trying to imagine what's going through your mind. What was it in your life that gave you the faith that somehow this is going to be for somebody's good, if not mine?
Well, growing up, my grandmother and grandfather taught me, I mean, they used to make me go to church all the time. And I didn't think I was getting anything out of it, but they would tell me things like, no matter what situation you're in, there's someone in a worse situation than you, so be thankful for what you have. And to always keep faith, faith in yourself, faith in God. So it was just those things that kept me focused.
Mark Rabel, when you see this every time, how difficult is it, or can you? Is it difficult for you to watch the film?
The first time I watched it, they had sent a copy to me to watch at home, and I turned it off about four or five times, so it took me about a day to watch it. And it would, some of the things that it brought back were so bad to remember that I'd forgotten. There's a scene in the conference room when we got the word from the Supreme Court and when we had to tell Daryl that we lost in the North Carolina Supreme Court in 1994. And I have to say that there, probably one of the most poignant moments in the film is when the speakerphone goes dead when we're talking to Daryl, and you just hear this dial tone, and it seems like an eternity before that goes off. Now, you would think that's something that would stick in my mind forever, but I guess I had successfully repressed that until I saw the film, and it just brought it all back. That was just so horrible. I mean, when I watched it the first time, and every time since then, and then we really had no idea what was going on Daryl's end until the film came out, and we talked about it in some of these public forums.
Well, people describe, and Daryl has described, you described what you go through and what you went through seeing the film, and hope and confusion are words you use. Anger is not one of them. Mark, in this process, did you become angry in seeing this film?
I was angry from the get-go. I know I put my fist through one door in 1986, and I slammed my fist on the courthouse door in 1994 when the judge ruled against us on the DNA, and I think I broke a bone there. And, yeah, I mean, whereas Daryl was able to not let anger control him, I was free to let people see my anger because I was on the outside. Yeah, I let the anger out. Daryl couldn't show his emotions. He couldn't let the guards know how he felt.
Talk a little bit more about that, because anybody who has seen you, Daryl, since, and anybody who has seen the film, and you've gone around now with the film, so people must ask you, how did you do it, and how do you do it?
I have never been a angry person. For me, one of the things that when I first got convicted and went to prison, it was an older gentleman who had been in almost 20 years, see me walking around the yard, and he called me and he said he wanted to tell me something. And he said, you know, if you want to live, he said, don't be angry, because anger eats you up from the inside out. And he asked me, do I want to live? And I said, yes, because I want to prove my innocence. And I would take that with me every day. I'll never forget it, even 20 years from now.
But that was sound advice that someone gave you, but I'm guessing you didn't see many examples of that. Everybody, many of the people you saw were angry, expressed anger?
People have different reasons for expressing anger. In my immediate environment inside, it was, you see that, and you just try to figure out, you know, why this person is angry. But for me, every day I would try to find something positive. If someone did not speak to me in a month, and then one day he just walks by and speaks to me, that's a positive day for me. So I would always try to find something positive to keep me focused.
You now have a foundation called the Daryl Hunt Project for Freedom and Justice. Is that taking up most of your time? Is that what you do now?
Yes. I work with that most of every day. It's almost a 7-day And
tell us a little bit about what it is.
We do a couple of things. We work with the Innocence Projects around the state with the schools to help other innocent people get out of prison. And the big part of my job is reentry. People getting out of prison, period. Trying to help them find jobs, housing, clothing, and trying to educate the public about the problems that they face, because people think that you send people to prison and they go to prison and get rehabilitated and come back out. But in reality, they go to prison. Prisons is just a warehouse that's making money off of them and sending them back to the street so they can turn around and go back to prison. Because people don't know that prisoners, when people are released from prison, they have to pay the parole and probation officer, be on parole and probation.
We're listening to my conversation with Daryl Hunt, exonerated for crimes he did not commit after a nearly 20-year ordeal with the penal system. Also with me that day was attorney Mark Rabel. I spoke with Daryl in 2007, 9 years before his apparent suicide. Our conversation continues on the State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Please stay with us. This is the State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow, remembering a conversation from 2007 with Daryl Hunt, who was wrongfully convicted in the 1984 rape and murder of Deborah Sykes in Winston-Salem. Daryl's attorney, Mark Rabel, was also with us. Before the break, Daryl was explaining that people released from prison are required to pay a fee for their parole supervision regardless of whether or not they have a job. I was incredulous. I came back to it in this segment and wanted to know what would happen if you failed to pay.
The parole officer will violate them.
Yeah, that's it. You have to do it. How much is it? What's the fee?
I think it's like $35 a month. And they have to pay this along with if they have restitution, child support, then they have to find a place to stay, pay rent, buy food, buy clothes, transportation back and forth if they find a job.
So you would hope that the parole officer or somebody in the criminal justice system is working on that part of it.
Yes, but they're not. They tell them either have my money or I'm going to violate you. And they wind up going out, committing crimes just to bring money to pay for the probation officer, parole officer, so they won't violate them.
Well, we have your former attorney, Mark Rabel, is also with us today. Mark, is that unique to North Carolina? Does that happen everywhere?
I think each state has their state-run mafia like that.
The state-run mafia? Yeah, I mean, so, and this is legal. This is how the system works. So people go back and tell us about your foundation then. What happens if we become connected with your foundation?
Well, what we try to do at Daryl Hunt Project is help them find housing, clothing, all their needs, and help them find a job. We help them find, send them through programs to prepare them for a job. And we also, if they want to go to school, we try to help them get in a school so they can get a trade. So they can go into their own business, because in North Carolina, and like most states, if you have a felony, then employers won't hire you. It's so bad now that if you have a misdemeanor, they won't hire you.
Well, so what do you do? I mean, if that's true, then how do you prepare anybody for a job?
Try to find jobs in the area that, like, we use Church's Chicken, restaurant jobs. We use body shops. We send a lot of students through a body shop training so they can go into body work and auto mechanics and things like that.
Now, how did you figure out what to do that the state of North Carolina either has chosen not to do or simply can't get done?
Well, they chose not to do it because they can do it. The state of North Carolina, they need to fill up the prison beds. So they're not going to rehabilitate nobody not to come back to prison. They're going to lose money.
Yeah, but we're tough on crime. We want to wipe out crime. We want to get these criminals off our street and reduce crime, as we hear all the time. Don't we?
You're producing crime because you're forcing people to either starve to death because they cannot even receive food stamps because they have a certain type of felony. Okay, and they can't get a job. They can't get housing. So what are you forcing them to do? The homeless rate goes up because people are homeless. And then they're starving to death, so they either going to commit a crime to feed themselves, or, and the majority of them, and I say 90% of the people, do not want to go back to prison. They want a job. They want to take care of their families. They made a mistake, and it's the only thing that you can be forgiven for anything in the world except for committing a crime. Once you commit a crime, you cannot be forgiven for it. It's like a life sentence.
I want to ask Mark Rabel a question. From your perspective as a defense attorney, you're working against prosecutors all the time, and you heard what Daryl said about producing criminals and about, you know, sort of having to fill beds. Now, it sounds at one level almost conspiratorial. When you work with prosecutors, do you get the sense that they see that as part of their job? I mean, I'm trying to figure out how conscious all of this really is.
It's most likely entered into the subconscious level. I don't think that most prosecutors really think about the penal system. I don't think that they are aware of the things that Daryl's talking to us about. I mean, you know, a lot of times I'm critical of prosecutors because I see the results, but by and large, most of the prosecutors are pretty good people who are trying to do their job, and they're trying to protect the victims that they see out there. But they really don't think about it. I mean, they want to be tough on crime, as you were talking about, which is, you know, most politicians want to be tough on crime. I guess I should say 110% want to be tough on crime, but they don't really think about what they're doing. And what really makes me grateful that we got Daryl out of prison finally was so that he could blow the whistle on what's really going on. I mean, as a criminal defense attorney, I have to say, I had not really had any depth of understanding about what goes on behind those walls. Daryl didn't talk about a lot of these things. He intimated a lot of these while he was in, but it took his freedom and his exoneration and the certainty that he can't go back for those same things again for him to be free to say these things. And now the good thing about being in the national and international limelight is he has a certain degree of protection because the authorities are not going to come after him as quickly as they did before. So, you know, Daryl, for example, he should tell you about Abu Ghraib and the similarities that he saw there that he saw in the Salisbury prison unit. I mean, he can talk about these things now because he has authority and he has a certain degree of protection.
Well, tell us a little bit about that, about life on the inside.
It's a whole lot different. You learn a lot, and you learn how the system works. And one of the things that the 34,000 inmates in North Carolina prison can't speak about is that because the reason why they can't speak about it because no one will listen to them because they are where they're at. Right. People have talked about this. They tried to get this out, but won't nobody listen to them because they're convicted felons and they're locked up. But there's torture. There's all kinds of abuse go on.
Torture, what do you mean? What form does it take?
People think when they see what happened in Iraq with Abu Ghraib and all that, they think that was something over there. But they do that right here in North Carolina, in the jails, in the prisons here. They tie them down, handcuff them to beds while they're naked and leave them there and check on them every hour. They do that right here in North Carolina. So that when I seen the pictures, and I've told Mark and everybody else that I talked to that I thought I was seeing pictures of the prison right here at Salisbury, Piedmont Correctional.
Yeah, but they were talking about stringing people upside down and using dogs. And
they do worse than that in North Carolina. But see, the problem is they have immunity, so nobody can question them.
Did any of that happen to you?
No, not to me. I was more quiet.
And I guess the other side of this, both from, you talked about producing prisoners, trying to get people in, and then what happens on the inside, is that you're picking on people who are easy to arrest. Your case was one. You were voiceless, somebody who nobody was going to come to your defense as a young man.
Yes, and that happens so much. And that's why I do the things that I do now, is being a voice for those who can't speak for themselves.
Do you see any of that changing? We've had a lot of cases. There's the Alan Gell case. There's your case, the Duke LaCrosse case. In many instances, these are three to name, just three, that point to a criminal justice system that is a criminal injustice system in this state. Does this lead to changes? Are things getting better?
They are getting somewhat better. I wouldn't say they're getting a whole lot better. You mentioned three. There's also Ronald Cotton, Leslie Jean, who was before me. The laws have changed a little. They are making some more changes, but you know, you mentioned the Duke LaCrosse case, which is, until that case, no one was really paying attention. So now they're paying attention, and you know, our Attorney General, Roy Cooper, said that, you know, he talked about District Attorney Nifon, how bad he was. But when you look at the trials of Darrell Hunt, the prosecutor who prosecuted me, who withheld the DNA evidence and stood there and called me a murderer and all this, is still working for Attorney General Roy Cooper right now in his office. So if you're going to talk about one, you need to, if you're going to clean up one, then you need to clean all of it up and be fair.
How did you feel about the attention that case got?
I think it was good, because people was finally able to really get to see it wasn't a black guy that was accused. You had four white guys that was accused, and they had money. And the same thing that people have been saying for years, that if you got money, you can pay for justice. And that's what happened.
Yeah.
Because if it would have been African-American that was charged, they'd have been convicted and sent to prison, and we'd have been waiting 20 years from now to find out that they was actually innocent.
Do you have any sense about the difference or the importance of race versus money? An African-American with a lot of money gets off too?
Yeah, I think it's wrong. I think justice is supposed to be about justice. I mean, everybody's supposed to be treated equally. And if you got money or if you don't have any money, you're still supposed to receive justice if the justice system was working.
So take us back a little bit to your childhood and what you saw from the streets of Winston-Salem growing up, your sense of the criminal justice system, how the police, you know, what that meant when they came through your neighborhood. I mean, what was your sense of the police role in Winston when you were growing up, a little boy?
Well, I was naive.
Yeah.
I didn't think anything about too much about the race issue or about police officers. I believed in the system until I was arrested and charged and convicted for something I didn't do, but I grew up believing in the system. I respected the police officers, and I believed that they would tell the truth, and because that was their job. There was incidents in Winston-Salem that I vaguely remember, but for me, being naive, 19 years old at that time, I was still naive as to how the system worked.
And you lost your mother when you were 9 years old. She was murdered.
Yes, my mom, she was murdered when I was nine. I never knew who my father was. My grandfather and grandmother raised me, and both of them passed when I was like 13. So
then where did you go then?
I was adopted by my uncle, and I was raised there. And I dropped out of school in ninth grade, couple of years later.
It's interesting to think about all you've been through, and now you've got a very successful foundation that's trying to do a lot of good work. That's who you have become. Did you have thoughts about who you were going to be growing up, going through all of this turmoil?
Yes. For me, I wanted was to work for the city of Winston-Salem in the street division, like my grandfather, who worked there for 36 years. Get a house, get married, have kids and a dog. And that was my dream. Even up until I was arrested, I was still trying to do that. They didn't talk about that. They don't talk about that, but I would go to the city every week trying to get on. They just wouldn't hire me.
Did they say why?
Part of it was because I was too young.
Yeah. You grew up in Winston and went to Mebane Elementary, and you met a teacher who had become one of your strongest defenders. Tell us about Joanne North Getz, who you call Ms. North.
Ms. North, yeah. Yes. She was my sixth grade school teacher. She was the one teacher that you knew cared, that you knew who taught you things that and really showed you that they cared. And went out their way to help you grow. I was probably on the small end of dumb growing up. But she helped me, and she worked with me. And to this day, she still teaches me.
Well, what is it that lets you know? I mean, what kind of things would happen that made you think this is somebody who really cares about me?
She was involved and she talked to my grandfather and them and let them know what I was doing. She would keep them informed, even though he couldn't get to the job, get to the school because he was working. She would call him and tell him. And she would have me, when she wanted me to stay over from school, she would call him and tell him she got me staying over to do some extra work.
A little extra work. Yeah. Never get in trouble? Did you get in trouble much at school?
Not in her class.
Hey, she called you the mouse hunter. What? Why? Yeah. Why was that?
Mebane was a real old school, and it had a lot of mouse and rats.
Mice,
and
yeah.
And everybody else was scared to get them. So I would put the traps down and come in early. To school early before all the students, rest of the students got there, and I would clean them up. And so that's
got,
where
you got. You were the mouse hunter.
Yeah.
Extraordinary. They didn't want to let go. How far did you go in school then?
I dropped out in the ninth grade.
And what were you doing then?
Really just hanging out. Yeah. And I went to California for almost 3 years, and I was working and going to school out there, trying to get my GED out there. And I came back to North Carolina.
It's interesting that your foundation is working on, you know, reentry, getting convicted felons in most cases back into the workplace, and that you're not working solely on cases of wrongful conviction.
Well, I'm doing as much as I can on wrongful conviction. It takes a lot of money and a lot of resources. And, you know, North Carolina has more innocent cases than the ones that they have let out. But for some reason, it's so hard to get into the files. A lot of things have been destroyed. And they're more protective.
You said that you were naive growing up in terms of understanding the relationship between the police, criminal justice system, and poor communities and poor African-American communities. What's your understanding now?
Oh, phew. That's a big one.
Mm-hmm.
Because now I see a lot different. I look at things differently. I still have utmost respect for police officers and the job that they do, and I know they must do it. I don't have no respect for those who intentionally lie and abuse people or who harass people for no reason. The system itself could be better if the people that runs the system That's the problem. Witnesses.
Are they doing it because they're hateful, or are they doing it because it's just easy to get away with it or get a conviction and walk away?
It's easier to get a conviction because if you get a conviction, then you can move up the career ladder.
Replaying my conversation with Daryl Hunt, a man who spent 19 years in prison for crimes he did not commit. He was ultimately exonerated and pardoned. I spoke with him and attorney Mark Rabel in 2007, 9 years before Daryl's apparent suicide. We'll talk more about his case and his life just ahead. Stay tuned. This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stachow, listening back to a conversation I had in 2007 with Daryl Hunt, who spent 19 years in prison for crimes he did not commit. He went through two trials, convicted both times, this despite no physical evidence. His ordeal is told in an HBO documentary, The Trials of Daryl Hunt, that premiered a few months before I spoke with him. Also with us was Daryl's attorney, Mark Rabel. After Daryl's release, he renewed his marital vows with his wife, April, and I asked him what role she played in his life.
Wow, she was a big part. When we first met in 1990, for my second trial, and we became friends, and then I went back to prison. And we lost communication because I just wanted her to move on with her life. And she found me again in 97. And I had moved to another prison, and she started coming back to see me, and we got married in 2000. She has been there. One thing I'd like to, what is that, during the, when the U.S. Supreme Court turned us down in October of 2000, we were supposed to be getting married the next day. Mm. And so that morning she came down, and I was thinking, well, we ain't going to get married because I ain't going to never get out. And I asked her, you know, that, and she said, well, what that got to do with us? And so we got married, and a couple of years later, that's when I was released.
How did you meet?
When I was out on bond, her father, Imam Khaled Griggs, I was staying at their house during that time, and that's how we became friends, just talking every day about the case. And I remember when Nelson Mandela got out of prison, we were standing there watching it together and talking about it. So,
but then you lost touch for 7 years. Were you thinking about it that whole time?
Yeah, I would think about it, but I was moving. They was moving me from prison to prison, and I didn't know how long I would be in prison or if I would ever get out of prison. I didn't want to ruin her life.
Well, can you allow yourself even to imagine that a life, a married life? I would think that would be pretty hard even to let yourself imagine.
Yeah, but you have to have hope in something. And one thing about being in prison, you only have your faith and hope. And if you lose those two things, you lose everything. And then to have others to have faith in you, that helps you stay stronger.
Tell us about your faith. You talked about the imam who is your wife's father.
Yes.
And you converted to Islam.
Yes. I converted in November the 5th, 1985. And after reading the autobiography of Malcolm X, I just wanted to know more about Islam. And one of the things you learn, and I learned, we talk about forgiveness. But you know, for me, I learned that in order for me to ask God to help me or to forgive me, I got to first be willing to forgive others for what they've done to me, or I don't have the right to go to God and ask God to help me or forgive me. So if you can't do that, then you don't have a right to ask God to forgive you if you're not willing to forgive anybody else.
So do you go through exercises? I mean, how do you help yourself get to that point?
You just stay conscious. You're always thinking about the other side, putting yourself in somebody else's shoes.
That has to be a difficult thing to do in prison. I'm just making a guess that there's a fair amount of hostility there, and you're always faced with, maybe I'm wrong.
You're faced with a lot, but the one surprising thing, what people don't realize about prison is that in prison, and it's amazing because it don't happen out here. In prison, everybody uses the same washcloth, the same towel, you know, the same sheets, same blankets. They just washed. But you wouldn't have that out here. And we know that. So we know it. I'm going to use your towel that you used last week. And you get along. Everybody comes from different backgrounds. There's still problems. There's still racism. And a lot of it is perpetrated by the system. The system separates people according to their race. You got guards who would separate a black and a white guy. If they're friends, they're going to drive a wedge through it to keep them separated.
And who do you pray for now?
I pray for everybody. I still pray for Miss Jefferson. I pray that she gets peace.
The Deborah Sykes mother.
Yes.
Yes.
I pray for all the people that I left in prison and hoping that they too one day will be free.
You talked about, we talked about Mrs. Jefferson, Deborah Sykes' mother. You've been clear from the outset that you said, look, you only lost 19 years of your life. They lost a daughter. You've been clear to make that distinction. Do you still have a relationship? Do you have any contact with Sykes?
No. But I understand it's going to take, it's a process that she was lied to for 20 years. And it's just going to take time for her to heal. And it's not like with me, I'm still living. So I still got some days left. But, you know, with her, she lost her daughter. And it's just going to take time for her to heal.
I'm curious about how aware you were of the media coverage of your case throughout the 18 years. Did you know much?
I felt a lot of it. Some of it, I was able to read. People would send me different clips. But a lot of what I would get would be from the pressure that I would receive from the Department of Corrections, from the correction officers.
What do you mean?
Well, my first 6 years, I was basically fighting for my life in the Department of Correction. There was contracts out on me. The guards was trying to set me up to go outside the fence at Caswell to dump some grease and shoot me for attempting to escape. There was all kinds of death threats on me, and a lot of this information that the inmates knew came from the prison guards. It didn't come from their own sources because they was just as ignorant as I was about what was going on outside, and this information was coming from people inside. Even when I was validated up in Marion, it was because of the captain used to be on the police force in Winston-Salem. And he figured out that I was there, so he figured out a way to get me validated and locked up.
So these are, and you believe these were actual, in retaliation for your effort to become exonerated?
Yeah, well, they felt that a black man had committed a rape and murder of a white woman. And in prison, it's a no-no. It's just like a child rapist or something. So every day it was a constant battle.
How did you find out that these were tricks, that these were setups, for instance?
Well, as far as the one at Caswell, when they were trying to shoot me there, when they was making their plans, they didn't know that a guy named TC, TC was in the bathroom cleaning up in the sergeant's office when they was making the plan. And after they left out, he came in the block and told me, don't get on the grease detail. And I was like, what you mean? I didn't know. This is my second day at the prison camp. And I thought he was playing. So when I went to chow, after I got through eating, I was taking my tray up, and the guard said, well, they're hunting you on grease detail, be out here at 8 o'clock. And I'm like, what is grease detail? He said, you'll find out at 8 o'clock. So 8 o'clock, they called me. I went out, and he said, well, you're going to take this wheelbarrow grease across the street and dump it in this field and come back. And I told him I can't do that. He said, why? I said, because I have a life sentence, and I'm not allowed outside the fence. And he said, well, I'm giving you a direct order to do this. And I refused, and I was wrote up. I had four disobeying direct orders on me for that one incident.
And what was the punishment for that?
They gave me extra duty. Mm. And the extra duty was to take these little hand tweezers and go outside the fence and get down and get the grass out between the fence, outside the fence.
So you were outside the fence again?
Yeah, I refused that too. But
so that's how one became four.
Yeah. And, you know, it was just during that time. And I actually had to go to lockup, be on solitary confinement, and be transferred to another camp just to save my life.
But you said this was going on for 6 years, right?
Yes.
Things like this.
Yeah, it was always something a little bit different. It was other things like the contracts with the skinheads where they had, it was going to take me out. There was six other guys who used to stay up at night. And so I could get an hour of sleep just watching over me so I can get an hour of sleep. So when nobody stabbed me while I was asleep, and they would walk with me to the chow hall.
Wow. To the chow hall. Why did they, how did you become friends with them? Why did they take on this?
I didn't know them. But they had read a little and heard a little about my case, and they knew I was innocent and I was fighting it. And so.
Because that answer, maybe that's part of the answer to the next question, which is in a situation like that where the guards have so much control, if they wanted to get you, my question is, why didn't they? How did they miss?
Well, they didn't get me because I think God was protecting me. Because I can look back at it now, and I have since I've been out, at all the times that I was vulnerable, that there wasn't nobody around me, and I was in a situation. I was so paranoid at one time that I was scared to walk the yard because you had to stay 10 feet away from the fence, but the actual track around the fence was like 5 feet away from the fence. So you're seeing these guards standing up here with these guns, and you, any little thing, they could shoot you and say you was trying to escape. So I thank God that he was protecting me.
Has it been difficult for you to adjust? How long did it take you to lose? You talked about being paranoid. Any other, how difficult was it to make the adjustment?
I'm still adjusting every day. I mean, I'm sitting here now using a technique that I used in prison.
What is that?
Watching the mirror to see what's behind me. Watching that glass to see that glass that I can see behind me.
You're safe. It's Robin Copley.
Yeah,
you're
okay. I can see everything behind me. I mean, that's that's how you had to live in prison. I mean, you had to know everything that was around you. And I use it every day. I still use certain things. And I'll probably always be that way.
Mark Rabel, Daryl Hunt's attorney, is also with us in the studio today. You've been through quite a bit of this yourself. Obviously, you've had the same, or well, not the same, but you've been on an emotional roller coaster as well. What are some of the lessons that you've taken away from this whole ordeal?
Well, there's a lot. I guess the basic one is the contagiousness of Daryl's faith. He had it from the very beginning. I mean, a lot of people say that, well, it's a good thing he got charged with murder so he could be saved from himself. And people, even in the last few days, I've heard people say to me, well, it's, you know, he would have been killed out there. He was involved in all this. And really, none of that was true. And so I've learned from that a lot of different things. I've also learned to look at my other clients in a different way. Even as a criminal defense attorney, I would not say that I have always practiced the presumption of innocence. I mean, of all people, you would think your attorney would start out assuming that you're innocent. But we get jaded. And even with Daryl, before I met him, I assumed, well, he must have had something to do with it because he's charged. Mm-hmm. And that was usually the case. The big thing in my professional life that I've learned is presume innocence and look at things in a different way. Change your awareness, change your consciousness. This is what I tell other criminal defense lawyers now. At least go through the exercise of assuming that your client didn't do it and look for other explanations as to why your client has been charged. And I guess the other thing is I've learned is the power of telling a story. And now that Daryl's story is finally told, and I think our filmmakers have done it wonderfully. Daryl tells his story beautifully now as well, but the film, The Trials of Daryl Hunt, tells a great story. And when people of all races see what was done to one individual who happened to be black, then they can understand the power and the errors of the system. And that's, to me, a big cure for what we call racism. If you can truly sit in the place of the other person and understand what it is that they want and that they need, then you can at least be aware of your own racism. I'm aware of my racism now. I'm a Winston-Salem native. I grew up as a white person, and I know my limitations, and I try to acknowledge that. And I think that may be part of the cure, hopefully, for the next generation.
How do you see it, Daryl, as you tour with this film, and now you're talking to more and more people, what do you think the impact of this film is going to be?
I think the real impact is saving lives. And the more people who see this film actually would look at it and say that, how did I treat someone? Or how did I destroy someone's life? And can I make sure that I don't be in the same position to do that to someone else?
That was my conversation with Daryl Hunt, wrongfully convicted of murder and rape, exonerated and pardoned after spending 19 years in prison. Also with us was Daryl's attorney, Mark Rabel. I spoke with him in 2007. That was 9 years before Daryl was found dead of an apparent suicide. North Carolina Public Radio is a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.